for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The federal government has consistently raised the debt ceiling since it was established back in 1917. The limit has gone from less than $1 trillion in the 1980s to $6 trillion in the 1990s to $14.3 trillion today. Raising the limit is usually a token practice, but this year, things are different. Today, we look at the forces driving the debate and the economic repercussions. Joining me in the studio, Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, John Harwood of CNBC and the New York Times, Global Economics Advisor David Smick, and John Fury with Quinn Gillespie Communications. I do invite your calls, questions. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook. Send us a tweet. And don't forget, you can also listen live, streaming at drshow.org. Good morning, gentlemen. Good
morning, Diane.
John Harwood, first of all, what is driving the debt?
Well, generally speaking, it's the fact that for a number of years, we've wanted more government than we're willing to pay for. And so we've got to borrow the difference. And whether that's in security policy or whether it's in entitlement programs to support poor people and the elderly with health care, or whether it's cutting taxes because people want lower taxes and some people think it's going to help the economy, we've been running deficits for a long time, with just a few exceptions since 1969. And so that we accumulate debt year by year. And in a period of economic downturn like we've just been through, that mushrooms the amount of debt that we've got to experience because we had a big stimulus program and other expenditures.
And do we sort of automatically just raise the debt ceiling every time we reach it? Is this year's debate unusual?
Well, it's not unprecedented. Sometimes it's more pro forma than others. It depends on the political circumstances of the time. But, of course, back when John was serving in the House of Representatives as a senior staffer and Newt Gingrich was leading the Republican Revolution, the debt limit was also figured in a big budget face-off between President Clinton and Republicans. So the drama associated with raising the debt limit can be very large because it has to be done. And if you don't do it, the consequences can be pretty severe.
How close are we right now?
Treasury says that we will hit the debt ceiling if nothing unusual was done by mid-May, but that there are ways in which they can maneuver money around so that they won't truly exhaust their authority to borrow until the first week in July. And so that is the functional deadline that political Washington's operating under for when the debt limit has to go up.
John Harwood of CNBC and the New York Times. David Smick, what happens if we breach that debt limit?
Well, I think it's going to be a real problem, but I got to tell you, it does not necessarily mean default. This month's, not raising the debt ceiling would be a mistake and would be messy, but let's just imagine there's still a lot of tax revenue coming in. The current Economist magazine, for instance, says if you look at this month, we have a $5 billion interest payment. We have revenues of $343 billion. So there's a lot of revenue. If need be, the Treasury could pay off foreign bondholders. They could pay Social Security checks. They could go through a lot of things. Now, there will be a shortfall, but and it's certainly not recommended. But when I hear this message that if you don't do the debt limit, it's automatically you default, that's not necessarily the case. And I cannot imagine that the Geithner Treasury, if they have the tax revenue, wouldn't wouldn't, you know, pay the interest. It's just what this whole situation reminds me of is World War One. It's like you have both sides digging the trenches, and I think in a lot of ways the president has a pretty good political argument about you know, the Republicans have to come to the middle. They have to talk about taxes. The problem is, I think the markets are moving too fast to make it to July. You saw the S&P warning. This weekend, all the central bankers and bankers were in Washington for the IMF World Bank meeting. The German Central Bank told one of the bankers that I was talking to, I noticed, the regulator in the German Central Bank said, I noticed that you've just bought some treasuries for a hedging operation because you needed additional liquidity, U.S. treasuries. We would warn against that. Now, it wasn't about dumping treasuries, but it was warning about buying new treasuries. So the global market, this bond market, is moving so fast. I'm not sure Washington is going to be able to string this out to the big showdown in July.
David Smick, he's founder and editor of the International Economy magazine. Turning to you, Dean Baker, what does the White House want?
Well, presumably they want a clean bill. They want an increase in the debt ceiling that basically says we're increasing the debt ceiling. And, you know, again, as Dave said, they have a strong position here because what you're talking about is spending money that's been appropriated. So it's not as though, you know, President Obama wants to go out and grab money from out of the sky and spend it on whatever he might like. I mean, he might like the programs. Point is, Congress has approved every single dollar in spending. So they've approved the spending, they've approved the tax structure, and what increasing the debt limit means just, you know, letting go through what Congress has already approved. And if Congress tries to put stipulations that, you know, take an extreme case, you know, we want, you know, they want Representative Ryan's plan for Medicare, well, you know, put that up for a vote. Don't hold the country hostage for
it. You mean put it up separately?
That's right. That's right. If Representative Ryan, the Republicans in Congress say, okay, we want to, you know, put this voucher system in place for Medicare, I mean, that's a fine argument to have, but don't attach it to the debt ceiling. Let there be a clear vote on that. That's what President Obama is going to be saying.
Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and John Feary, will Republicans vote to raise the debt limit?
Eventually, some will. I think you'll get a majority of the majority voting for to raise the debt limit because ultimately you have to do it. My guess, though, is that you'll get a lot of Democrats having to vote for it as well. You know, I think a lot of Republicans look at the old Rahm Emanuel admonition, never let a crisis go to waste. And typically in American history, when you raise a debt limit, you do get something out of it, especially if you have a major financial crisis.
And what do Republicans want?
Well, they want significant spending reductions.
What does that mean?
That's the ill-defined thing. Jim DeMint says he wants a balanced budget amendment. I don't think that's practical within the next month or a half. I think that one idea would be a Medicare commission like they had with the Social Security Commission. I think that Republicans ultimately want significant spending reductions, and I think they're keeping their cards fairly close to the chest to give them the maximum amount of negotiating room.
And to what extent can what they want be separated out from the budget ceiling debate, the debt ceiling?
Well, I think that in the past what you've done is you've done temporary increases to the debt limit, so that's a possibility to kind of kick the can down the road a bit. I mean, this is going to be an ongoing negotiation, it's been going since the Republicans got in control of the Congress. And the fact of the matter with the S&P, it's almost downgrading our debt right away, you know, this gives them additional impetus to say, listen, we've got to do something. And I think that this election was one of the first times where the people said, okay, we've had enough. We've got to cut spending. And now the Republicans, I think they feel like they have momentum on their side.
But at the same time, hasn't Eric Cantor said, we don't want to play around with the country's credit rating?
No question. And I think that's ultimately why you'll get an agreement and the debt limit will be increased.
Diane, I think it's important
John
to point
Harwood.
Out there. It is popular for people to talk about political Washington is a bunch of jokers who are fighting and don't care about the national interest. I do think there is something encouraging about the way both parties have conducted the debate over the last few weeks. They reached a deal on the 2011 budget, And now I think they have, in a way that you might want your public officials to do, they've shown signs of separating the things that they have to fight about over the next 2 years before the election. They are not going to settle the fate of the Medicare program in the next 2 months from the things that they do have to settle in the next 2 months. The debt ceiling is one of those, and I think the way to accommodate the spending cut desire, and you mentioned, or John mentioned, that there was a big demand from the public for spending cuts. That's sort of true, but if you look at the Washington Post ABC poll today and see strong numbers of people saying they don't want Medicare messed with. The public has contradictory ideas about these things. But I do think there is a common desire to cut spending over a long period of time by around $4 trillion, and that could be an outline that they settle on with fighting over enforcement and triggers and that sort of thing. And then they'll agree to have a big national debate before the 2012 elections on Medicare and on taxes.
David Smith.
Well, I think the public is scared for good reason. I mean, I'm not saying that we should believe the Republican data or the Democratic data, but when you look at the CBO, and I think these are earnest people who are trying to do the right thing, I mean, they describe entitlements as a giant Pac-Man. I mean, by 2025, which is not that long, federal spending on entitlements and interest payments will consume 100% of government revenues. And when you look at unfunded entitlement liabilities, the president of the New York Fed, a Democrat, came out just the other day and he said those liabilities are nine times our entitlement liabilities. Now, the CBO made data looks at one other thing. They looked and said if you tax the upper income level at 100%, we still have Medicare exploding in relatively soon.
David Smick is author of The World is Curved. Short break, right back. And welcome back. We're talking about the current debate in Washington over the debt ceiling, which it is predicted in mid-May will reach the limit. Whether to extend that debt ceiling is the subject of Republicans, Democrats, very, very strong feelings. John Harwood, Standard & Poor's, came out earlier this week warning that its top credit rating for the U.S. could be in danger. So how does that statement from S&P, considering the fact that S&P has its own problems, affect the debate?
I think it could help those people who want to make an agreement on reducing spending. It gives some momentum. It gives a talking point for people. And it reminds politicians of the stakes involved in this issue. Now, David was talking about how we wouldn't necessarily default if we don't raise the debt limit. And I defer to his knowledge of the economics and the way it would play out in a granular way. But it depends on your appetite for risk. If in fact, you run the risk of spooking investors, having interest rates go up, destabilizing the economic recovery, which is the argument that Tim Geithner makes and the president is making, and that is accepted by a lot of people in Congress, then I think that argues for getting something done. And Standard & Poor's may be, as several people said, be a wake-up call that helps that.
But, Dean Baker, should this debate over the debt limit be a political one?
Well, no, I think it's really kind of a distraction. And, you know, I think the fundamental questions, again, first off, we have a short-term issue, which should be getting people back to work. I mean, it's just kind of amazing to me. We're sitting here with close to 25 million people unemployed, underemployed, out of the workforce altogether. No one's talking about that. We're talking about the debt ceiling. I mean, those people should be furious because they're not unemployed because they messed up. They're unemployed because people like Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke messed up. So they should be very, very upset. They've just left the picture. We're talking about the debt ceiling. But, you know, in terms of some of these other issues, Standard & Poor's, I'm sort of, you know, I've been discussing this with all the economists and I go, what do they even think? Because the U.S. cannot default. Our debt is in U.S. They weren't talking about the debt ceiling. Their immediate issue was talking about the U.S. sustainability of its debt. And our debt is denominated in dollars. We could print as many dollars as we want. So we were sort of debating. We literally do not, and maybe someone here could tell me, I don't even know what that means. How do you default on dollar-denominated debt when you print dollars? Argentina could default on dollar-denominated debt. I don't even know what that means. And in fact, the markets don't seem to know what that means. Interest rates on U.S. government bonds fell the day they issued that warning.
John Ferry.
Oh, well, of course, this should be a political consideration.
Why?
The debt limit was established in the throes of World War I. Because they had to make a political consideration that they're not going to spend more money than they had, and so they had to make a promise to the voters. And so ever since then, we've made this promise to the voters, and politicians go through this exercise because they have to reassure their voters that they're looking out for their best interests, and the way they do that is by establishing a debt limit. Alan Greenspan said, you know, this past weekend, we shouldn't have a debt limit. Well, guess what? You have to, because politicians say this is the way they reassure their voters. And there's always been this push and pull in American history between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. Alexander said we got to have debt. Thomas Jefferson said, no, we shouldn't. So, you know, the fact of the matter is this is all about politics, and it should be because politics ultimately makes the decisions for this country.
How strong of an influence will the Tea Party members of Congress play in this debate?
The Tea Party members have a real decision to make. Do they want to be part of this process and be part of the negotiations, or do they want to sit on the sidelines like Barack Obama sat in the sidelines and said, I'm not going to vote for the debt limit, and he took himself out? You cannot take yourself out of this if you want to be a negotiator. If you want to be a workhorse, you have to say, I will vote for this under certain conditions. If you want to be a show horse, you'll say, I'm not going to vote for this no matter what. And I think too many of the Tea Party members are saying, I'm not voting for this no matter what.
Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina says he's going to go to extreme lengths to prevent a vote on raising the debt ceiling, even if it hurts the Republican Party.
Well, I think that's silly. I think that ultimately you have to be a negotiator and you have to be able to negotiate because we have responsibilities. When you're in the majority, you have responsibilities. And to filibuster this without really coming to some sort of agreement is not good for the country.
And Senator Mark Rubio of Florida says he's going to hold out for fundamental tax reform. I mean, everybody is sort of putting this big basket
If you look at John Boehner and Eric Cantor, they're saying we're going to negotiate. They're keeping their cards very close to the vest, which I think is exactly where they need to be.
David Smith.
I think it would be reassuring if this was just a game of political tag back and forth, but I think it's a lot more serious because a lot depends on the level of interest rates on the debt. Now, we're going to have the deadline in July for the debt limit, but there's also something happening at the end of June. The Fed is ending its QE2 monetary policy, and so we're going to have another at least $70 billion a month that we're going to have to come up with that the Fed had been putting into the economy. So the question is, do interest rates go up? I think it's a difficult argument to make to the public, but foreigners who hold our debt in recent years have moved to the short end of the debt, which means they used to buy 30-year bonds. Now they buy 3- and 4-year bonds. And that sounds technical, but what it means is that if interest rates go up, we have to roll over that debt, and so the bill grows exponentially for the interest payments. That's the time bomb that is making a lot of economists so worried about the debt situation, both Republicans and Democrats.
And joining us now is Mary Miller. She is Assistant Treasury Secretary for Financial Markets. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. Give me your reaction to the S&P downgrading its outlook for the United States.
Yes, thank you for that question. Basically, we respectfully disagree with Standard & Poor's. We think that there's a lot going on in Washington right now, and they should have allowed a little bit more time for the political process to run its course here. So they're making a political judgment about the fiscal resolve of the United States, and we simply think that that's wrong. And I would add that the other major rating agencies have not taken this step. In fact, one of them publicly said they think that things are moving in the right direction.
Indeed, Secretary of Treasury Timothy Geithner has said that Republican leaders have privately assured the administration that they will raise the debt limit. Is this still the case?
Well, I think publicly both parties have said that we need to raise the debt limit, and they expect to do that.
Why should the debt limit be increased, and by how much, Secretary Miller?
Okay, two questions. I talk about the debt limit as about the past. The debt limit speaks to authorizations that Congress has made for spending that have already been appropriated. So we simply have to raise debt to pay for things Congress has already asked us to do. The second question, you asked me first about the...
By how much?
Oh, by how much. That decision has always rested with Congress, and I think they have to determine, you know, how much time they would like to cement with the next debt ceiling. So we don't recommend an amount.
So, Secretary Miller, is the Department of the Treasury talking with Republican leaders to try to persuade them to put politics aside and to simply move forward on raising the ceiling?
Absolutely. We've done a number of briefings with staff members in Congress to educate them on the debt limit issues. And there have also been a number of meetings that the Secretary has had with the leadership of both parties and members of committee staff about
and,
the debt limit.
And what have been the reactions?
I think people take the matter quite seriously. They do understand that this is something that Congress needs to do. They want to understand all of the dates and issues and timing and steps around it. But I think as people are educated about it, they understand this is a necessary step.
Mary Miller, she's Assistant Treasury Secretary for Financial Markets. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And John Harwood, you want to...
I just wanted to make a point on what Secretary Miller said about the recognition within the Congress that this needs to be done. I thought it was a telling moment after the president's speech last week. I wrote about this in the Times the other day, when Paul Ryan, the chairman of the House Budget Committee, who had been in the front row while the president ripped his plan for Medicare as something that would take money from old people and give it to millionaires. And he was interviewed by my friend Larry Kudlow on CNBC, and Larry said, Congressman Ryan, after the president hit you the way he did on your budget plan, how can you work with him on the debt ceiling? And Ryan went off on the demagoguery of the president. It was outrageous. He's the campaigner in chief. But then he made a distinction, and he said, now on the debt limit, we're going to have to just put the president off to the side and realize that that's an issue that we've got to work with Democrats on and ignore the president. And I thought that was a signal that reflects the attitude among the leadership in the Congress that, in fact, they are going to do this and probably not push it too close to the brink.
Dean Baker.
Yeah, just getting back to the whole principle of a debt ceiling, I would differ strongly earlier with the point made earlier about how this is an important feature. No other country, there may be an exception here. I don't know of any other country that has debt ceilings, because keep in mind what we're talking about here. Congress has approved every tax we have in place. Congress has approved every spending bill we have in place. So we're saying, given what Congress has approved, you borrow as a result. That was Congress's choice. So now they're saying, oh, we didn't like what we did. We're going to go back and change it. Not by changing what we spend or changing what we tax, but by saying somehow the government can't do what we told them to do. That's a very strange institution.
David Smith.
I want to add a question for John Horwood, who's close to related to the politics of this. Obama's speech didn't make sense to me because it seems to me if he cuts a deal on the budget, the 2012 presidential election is over. I mean, the Republicans don't have strong candidates, and the bulk of the independents that supported him in 2008 and left in 2010.
What kind of a deal are you talking about?
Some kind of a long-term deal on the budget that gave some sense. And I was just surprised the question I have for John was the kind of partisan nature of the tone of the president's speech, was that kind of a response to the fact that they had been negotiating with the S&P, according to the Washington Post today, throughout the week, trying to get them to hold off, and so there needed to be some kind of diversion? Because I think the president makes a point. You know, the Republicans can't have it all. They have to compromise, and to have a compromise, presumably taxes would be on the table. But on the other hand, it just didn't seem like the kind of thing you would do to create your deal. Now, there are going to be some far-right Republicans who will never do it.
Let him answer.
Well, I don't see it that way. I think what the president's been doing throughout the year is feeling out the Republicans, seeing how far they were going to push, figuring out where he could ultimately draw a line and say, stop, enough. Okay. And I think when he made the deal on discretionary domestic spending, which mostly involves programs that aren't familiar to a lot of people. They aren't huge programs. But when you get to the defined benefit character of Medicare, that was a line the president felt he could stand his ground and fight on, just as Democrats stood their ground and fought on payroll taxes for Social Security when President Bush tried to partially privatize. And this is where President Clinton stood up against the Republicans in Congress. I think that's what the president was doing.
John Horwood of CNBC and the New York Times, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Ada, Michigan. Good morning, James. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. We understand that government spending spikes due to wars and then make an attempt to rescue an economy falling off a cliff. I heard Senator Bob Corker this morning on CNBC say that government spending needs to be reduced to a historical norm of around 20% of GDP. Where is the recognition of government tax revenue being at the lowest level of GDP in more than 50 years?
How do you respond to that, John Ferry?
Well, obviously, tax revenue is an issue, and I think that's partly an issue because the economy has been really lousy. And hopefully, I think the calculation the Republicans are making is if we keep tax rates low, the economy will come back quicker and we'll get more tax revenue. There's some justification for that theory because it happened in the late 90s when they cut taxes, the capital gains taxes, and they had an economic boom. So Republicans, this is part of the Republican theology that they believe if you keep tax rates low and not raise taxes, you'll have an economy bounce back quicker. I think that was also the president's calculation at the end of last year when he signed on to two more years of the Bush tax cuts that he now condemns so often.
Yeah, well, I'd agree with that in the sense that deficits will boost the economy in a downturn. That's what President Obama agreed to, and that's the point. There's a huge amount of economic evidence to support that. In terms of tax rates per se leading to growth, we've tested that. We tested that in the 80s. That was the weakest decade of growth in post-war period until the last decade, and we tested that again with President Bush. So you go, how many times are we going to test this with the whole economy?
And you even had Alan Greenspan spent his weekend saying you got to let all those tax cuts expire.
Well, right. And a lot of deficit hawks in the Democratic Party want to do the same thing. I'm sure that Dean disagrees with that. But, you know, Peter Orszag, the former budget director for the president, has also advocated that position. And one of the dramas about this negotiation and on David's point, about what kind of a deal he wants, I think the president wants, and I think Republican leaders think it's realistic to get a hollow deal. That is to say, the outlines of how much we're going to cut, then you fight over how much. And there are a lot of Democrats who think that a realistic way of closing our long-term deficit is going to require the president to give up his pledge not to raise taxes on middle-class people. Can I ask John Ferry one question?
Sure.
John talked about how he thinks in the end a majority of the Republicans will vote for the debt limit increase. Do you see the coalition that was assembled for the 2011 budget when you lost 59 Republicans, got 81 Democrats. Is that roughly what we're going to see on the debt ceiling?
I would think that you'd probably lose a few more Republicans and you'd probably gain a few more Democrats. My guess of what will happen with this debt ceiling, as it often happens with debt ceilings, especially when you have divided government, is you have a deal is cut where you get half the Democrats and half the Republicans, maybe one more of each, to put this thing together. I think ultimately that's what you're going to get, because this is going to be very politically, a very highly charged vote, because it's always a very politically highly charged vote, and most people want to take a walk on it because they don't want to go back to their constituents and say, guess what, I raised the debt limit, because it's just bad politics. So my guess is that if that'll be part of the deal. Get a significant number of Democrats, get a significant number of Republicans, one plus each, and make it a close vote.
John Ferry, he is a former congressional staffer for Bob Michael, Tom DeLay, Dennis Hastert. Short break and more of your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. By the David Geffen Foundation, supporting the vital role of quality journalism in this nation's civic life. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at Edutopia.org. This is NPR.
Raising awareness about autism. Former PBS NewsHour anchor Robert McNeil reports on the complex and puzzling disorder, how the condition affects families, schools, and communities. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. Time to go back to the phones to Sal in Orlando, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Morning. Yes, I have a question. Why should we have so much faith in S&P's latest action when this is the same agency that helped spark the subprime mortgage crisis by rating these mortgage bonds?
Dean Baker.
Yeah, well, it's a very good question. I mean, S&P's track record's a disaster. You know, in addition to the rating subprime mortgage bonds at AAA in many cases, or investment grade in every case, they rated Lehman as top investment grade until the week it went bankrupt, Bear Stearns, Enron. They have a long list of failures. And, you know, this is their opinion. One hopes that it's made based on their judgment. But even that, you know, they're facing regulation from Congress and the Dodd-Frank bill. You know, you just have to ask the question, you know, are they looking over their shoulder at politics? Are they trying to, or is this really their best opinion?
Here's an email from Richard. He's in Mount Vernon, Arkansas, who says, if there is a fight over raising the debt ceiling and a delay, is there the potential that home buyers with variable rate interest mortgages could see an upward bounce, further hurting the economy as well as the home building markets? David Smith.
Well, I certainly think if they don't pass the debt limit, as I said earlier, there'll be a lot of confusion. And so that confusion will probably disrupt the bond market short term. But, you know, this is a global bond market. And, you know, the Treasury is nervous right now, and they have reason to be, because globally we don't control our destiny on interest rates entirely. And, you know, we've had the Fed in buying, but the Fed has announced in all probability they'll stop buying bonds at the end of June. So that means we're basically vulnerable to the moves in the global. There is a theory, by the way, by some pretty smart people in Wall Street. Now, maybe all Wall Street shouldn't be trusted, but that this is a long-term cycle. The global bond market first took down the Asian economies because they were fudging their books in the 90s. Now they're taking down the European economies, particularly the European banks that have fudged their balance sheets, the sovereign debt on the balance sheets, and created fictitious values. And next stop will be the U.S.,
Yeah, just very quickly. I mean, I expect that interest rates are going to rise. They're at extraordinarily low levels today. I mean, they were even lower if we go back to last summer, but still a 30-year mortgage is somewhere around 4.8, 4.9. This is really extraordinarily low. So if people are asking about the general course of interest rates, I'd be very surprised if, say, 2 or 3 years out from now, they aren't, say, a percentage point or so higher. The impact of this, unless it really gets out of control, which, you know, again, I won't rule out, probably will be pretty minimal.
To Farmersville, Ohio. Hi, Kurt. You're on the air.
Yeah. I'd like to ask about repealing the Bush tax cuts and in relation to really where, you know, government stimulus programs began, you know, under Roosevelt, that they were intended for the most needy. And we're now sort of in a situation where it's not just the rich, but the middle class are living in conditions of relative luxury. So why can't everybody kick in a little more to try to take care of these problems?
John Ferry.
Well, you don't have to repeal the Bush tax cuts. You just have to let them expire, which the president decided that he wasn't going to do. I mean, I think that
under pressure.
Under pressure, sure. But he signed the bill, and the Democrats had vast majorities in both the House and the Senate, and he let it happen. The point being that raising taxes, especially for people making below $250,000, is extraordinarily unpopular. The Bush tax cuts get a bad rap, but they're still pretty popular with a lot of folks, and that's why the president and the Democrats decided to extend them.
Diane, one thing I think that gets lost in the debate, though, is that as we move forward, it's possible that the Bush tax cuts will become irrelevant because tax reform is an important part of this discussion.
What kind of tax reform?
Well, there are many ways you could go. You could go to broaden the base and lower the rates. That's one thing that people like to do. You could also, if you had economists draw it up on a chalkboard, they'd have a value-added tax and get rid of the income tax. It raises a lot of money, and it also realigns incentives in favor of taxing consumption and encouraging investment. I don't know. I think it's difficult to go that route or to go quickly in that route, but I do think there are ways in which the tax system is likely to change that will put some of this discussion behind us.
To Melvin Village, New Hampshire. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Diane. I'd like to know why the subsidies such as a farm subsidy and oil subsidies aren't being reduced to improve the deficit rather than programs that people have paid into, like Medicare and Social Security.
Dean Baker.
Well, that's a good question. I think there's sort of a simple answer. They have powerful lobbies. So, but, you know, as a practical matter, I do have to say it's not that much money in the scheme of things. It's still, you know, it's wasteful spending. Why would you have that? Just to go back to a point earlier, though, I think one of the reasons that there is so much resistance to raising taxes in the middle class is middle class have not actually done very well in the last three decades. The bulk of the gains of growth have gone to the top 10%. Particularly top 1%, there's been a redistribution to the richest 1% in the country, equal to 10% of GDP. That's $1.5 trillion a year. That could double the income of everyone in the bottom half of the income distribution. So you have a lot of middle-income people that have not, in fact, done very well over the last three decades.
All right. To Haverhill, Massachusetts. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Diane. Yeah, Alan Greenspan, I wish he had talked against Bush tax cuts when he was the Fed chair. Now he's out of mea culpa and change of heart. But, Diane, I'm invested in the market, and I'm over 70, so I have to take an annual automatic withdrawal every year. And I'm only paying 15%, and it used to be 15% on capital gains. I'm sorry, it used to be 20% on capital gains, and now it's 15%. And then these hedge funds guys there, they're multimillionaires and billionaires, and they're only paying 15% taxes. And I also, Diane, you know, I know Republican friends that I have. I'm liberal, I got to say that. But I find a lot of Republican people, they seem to be very self-centered and selfish. They do not think of the civic community as a whole. They don't believe in the social safety network for people. And so I'd like to have the panel comment on that, please.
John Ferry.
Give me all the softballs, huh? Listen, I think Republicans believe in a strong social safety net. What they don't believe in is a government that keeps growing with no accountability, with a budget that is bursting at the seams. And frankly, if you do not deal with entitlement spending, we are all going to go broke. The fact of the matter is that entitlement spending, especially Medicare spending, is crowding out all their spending. The reason we don't invest enough in education and other things is because exponentially, you look at from 1964 to the growth of the program, we are going broke, folks, and we've got to deal with entitlements.
Wait a minute, you're talking about my mom's health care.
I know, right. That's the problem. That's the hard part.
But I think the caller is on to something. But there is a perception around the country that Washington is just enmeshed in crony capitalism and that everybody gets a special deal. Big business, big labor, big government. Everybody's got their deal.
Big banks.
Big banks. I mean, it's it's the private equity firms. They go around now and talk about we need to have deficit reduction, but they've paid a 15% tax rate on carried interest, which is their principal source of income. But it's not just them. Everybody gets a deal, which is why I think John Hardwood is on something. Every 10 or 15 years, and I was involved in this in 86 with Bill Bradley and Reagan when they had a bipartisan effort to reform the tax code, you got to clean out the barn. This town is just, Washington is full of special deals, both parties.
Yeah. Just 50% of the country pays no income taxes. 50%. The bottom 50% pay no income taxes. They get money back from the government. So this is one of the problems we have. I agree that we should, if you're going to deal with, everyone needs to share in the sacrifice.
We have the highest corporate tax rate in the country, and yet GE and a lot of corporations pay no taxes.
Here is an email from Mark in Little Rock. I'm going to be interested in your reaction. He says, I'd like anyone to show me an American voter who had ever heard of the debt ceiling before this year. Republicans and those in the Tea Party are overplaying their hands if they actually believe that Americans give two hoots about the debt ceiling.
They don't care about the debt ceiling per se, but they do care about debt, and they care about debt about once every decade. This happens. It happened in 85. It happened in 95. But every time we are about to go broke, our debt becomes a big political issue, and then we somehow deal with it, and then it goes away as an issue. Dean's going to tell me right now, and I think he's absolutely right, that most people back in the country are worried about jobs and job creation and their personal well-being. When the debt starts to impact their personal well-being, as it's going to do, that's when it becomes a real political crisis.
What about the Gang of Six, John Harwood? Who are they? What role will they play in this whole issue?
The role the Gang of Six may play is to change the conversation to a place where you could have a long-term deal. And the requisite for that from the Republicans is that Democrats have to agree to significant cuts in entitlements, including Social Security. Republicans have to agree that we need some more tax revenue. Don't know how that it could come in various places. It could come from a tax reform. It could come from higher rates on the rich. It could come in any number of ways. But until those two things are stipulated by both sides, there will not be a long-term deal because neither party can muscle through a deal on their own, and neither would want to because it would be too politically risky. So they're negotiating something. It's a long road to get from 6 to 60, which you need in the Senate. You probably can't get to 60 until after you fight a presidential election over some of the underlying issues, but that's the breakthrough that they potentially represent.
Dean.
I just want to jump quickly back to a point John Tierney had made earlier about exploding entitlement costs. This really does get down to health care and particularly Medicare. And one of the things that, you know, I would give President Obama credit for, it's a mixed story here. If you follow the projections, both from the Medicare trustees and the Congressional Budget Office, his health care plan brought down projected expenditures hugely. Now, all these people respond by saying, that won't be followed, that's not real. Well, that is the law. So, you know, what they're saying is, well, we can't count on Congress to follow the law.
That may well prove right, but that was a huge step in reducing projected deficits going out 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah, but the CBO, I hate to go back to them, but they, you know, they say that if you raise taxes significantly on everyone earning joint income $114,000 and above, Medicare still goes broke. It's not, that's not a Republican or Democrats. That's, these are independent. Now, they could be wrong, but...
Dean Baker?
No, I think you're thinking of the alternative fiscal scenario, which is assuming in effect that the law is not followed. So I'm going, well, suppose the law is followed. Now, if you're telling me Congress won't follow the law, that's fine, but don't blame President Obama for not having put something on the table.
Yeah, there was a ton of brinkmanship over this last vote over the government spending bill. Did anybody learn anything from that, John Ferry?
I think that John Boehner and Harry Reid actually learned that they could work together, and they could work together very effectively by keeping Nancy Pelosi out of the conversation. And I think that, that you'll see that once again.
Why keeping Nancy Pelosi out?
Well, I think Pelosi tends to bring the more liberal wing of the party in. She actually voted against the agreement. And I think that Boehner and Reid think that they can do business with, by keeping her out. I think that's the one thing that they learned.
What about the extreme right?
Well, the extreme right also voted against it, but it was enough to – they got enough votes to pass this, and I think that that's going to be the way they're going to go through this, this
John
process.
John Ferry, he's president of communications, director of government affairs at Quinn Gillespie Communications, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. All right, let's go back to the phones and – let's see, to Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning, Brooks. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I got a simple question. I've never heard anybody talk about this, but it seems to me that before we fix the deficit, we need to fix the budgeting process. My question is, why is it that both parties in their budgeting create these wild, pie-in-the-sky projections that are absolutely, totally unattainable? Why don't we do zero-based budgeting like, you know, a lot of local and state governments do?
Dean Baker.
Well, zero-based budgeting has a mixed record. Jimmy Carter actually tried that back in the 70s, and it didn't work very well. I mean, what you often find is you end up spending a huge amount of time going through these budgets, and at the end of the day, you end up pretty much back where you started. So I don't think you're going to find a procedural fix. I mean, the bottom line here is we have spending that most people do value. They value their Medicare, they value their Social Security, and they don't want to pay higher taxes. I mean, that's the immediate obstacle here.
Dean Baker, how do you see this debate playing out? When do you see a vote coming?
Well, I'm sure we'll pass that May 16th deadline, and we probably will get
pass it.
Yeah, because, you know, for both sides, I think it's the Republicans will be seen as giving in if they agree to something by May 16th. So I think we will get to somewhere well into June, quite possibly, but July before you get a deal. And my guess is that most of the big things will not be included. There certainly will be something that the Republicans have to show, but probably not any of the big things.
Steny Hoyer, the Democratic whip, who did work with John Boehner, Kevin McCarthy, Eric Cantor, and the House leadership on the 2011 budget, told me that in a meeting at the White House last week, he proposed avoiding the drama, suspense, which could be damaging, of the countdown clocks we saw on cable TV over the government shutdown, and proposed that they resolve the debt limit by June the 8th. Republicans didn't commit to that, but he said that nobody said we can't do it. That might be a rough goal that they're trying to execute.
What do you think, David Smick?
I think in a lot of ways the markets are going to be have a say in this. It just has a feel.
What does that mean?
That means that suddenly it's not just S&P. Somebody else comes out, some central bank issues a statement questioning American debt, and suddenly there's a real fear of interest rates rising, and that kind of motivates Congress because the average congressman doesn't want to hear his constituent complain that their variable rate mortgage is suddenly soaring. You know, if you go back to the last decade of when we had high inflation and high interest rates in the 70s, I went back and I looked at the interest rates. It was, in this case, a 30-year bond. In July of 1977, the interest rates was the same as it was in July of 1970. And you say, how could that be? That was the decade of double-digit interest rates. It was suddenly, it just popped up. Suddenly, you know, it looked like everything was fine, and then the interest rates soared. And by the end of, 3 months later, by the end of 77, 6 months later, interest rates were soaring. And so we are assuming Everything is stable. We have a free lunch on the interest rate side, and I think that's going to potentially drive this.
We had the Iranian revolution quadrupling the price of oil.
Okay, okay. My guess is that we'll get this resolved. It's usually a big recess, so it's either going to be July 4th recess or August recess. My prediction would be August. That's my guess, because it's going to take a long time for them to come. Kind of, they might. The Treasury can do all kinds of things. I've been through this. They did it for 3 or 4 months after they passed the deadline in 1995. They did it again in 85.
Who's going to come out a winner here?
Nobody. It's going to be tough. I mean, you know, if the Republicans get all their spending reductions, they come out the winner.
John Ferry, David Smick, John Harwood, Dean Baker, thank you all.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.